Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
It's 8:07. You're listening to News Talk 830 WCCO Radio, your good neighbor station. My name is Shaletta Brundage. I am filling in for my friend Geraldine Steele. You can catch me on Saturdays from 11 to 2 on The Shaletta Show. But I'll be here tonight with you until 11, and we have an amazing lineup of guests, including Center Stage, All Things Arts and Entertainment, coming up at 9 o'clock. So you do not want to miss that. You know, I am waiting and looking forward to seeing Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, Gary Hines, Billy Steele, and the Sounds of Blackness perform from Paisley Park on tonight's Billboard Music Awards on NBC. I've got my recorder set. I've got the TV off in the distance. And, you know, as we look at them and see them, we're seeing history in the making. As we look around our city and our town, as we get ready to remember the anniversary of the death of George Floyd, we're living in history. Taking my kids out to the square, answering questions, meeting people there, having dialogue and conversations about what this means. Some of the things that we do today, some of the words that we say, will go down in history. How will that impact Minnesota? How will that impact our children, our community? Peter Burkholder, a Wisconsin native, so he's not too far away, and we won't hold that against him. He spent two decades right here in the Twin Cities, though, and he's a history professor at Farley Dickinson University in New Jersey. Thank you so much for being on Steel Talking.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Shaletta.
Now, Professor Burkholder, you know, folks will say, well, you know, I hear my grandmother say it all the time. I lived through this and I lived through that. And I was here when this happened. And I remember when that happened. You know, my grandmother just turned 100 years old this year. And you know, I sat at her feet and I remember as a child listening to those stories. And now, you know, my children are living in those stories, and somebody's going to sit at their feet as they talk about the pandemic, as they talk about the murder of George Floyd and Dante Wright. These are historic times.
Yeah, they are.
Talk to me about that.
I'm sorry, what was that again?
I said, talk to me about that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this is, it affects me too as a historian. You know, certainly I just ended teaching a course in the spring where we were looking at, you know, comparative pandemics. And it was the first time, you know, when I taught my students about Black Death, where they could empathize almost right out of the gate. And when we looked at cases of people in the 14th century blaming others, you know, for the disease, they immediately picked up on that. And, you know, so from an educational standpoint, there was a bit of a silver lining to, you know, what's a very horrible situation, by living through these times. The problem, of course, is that oftentimes, you know, we forget these things so quickly. So when those same students then look back on, like, the Spanish flu, and they said, well, we're making all the same mistakes, you know, now that they made 100 years ago, that was, you know, very frustrating to a lot of them.
And, you know, how difficult as a history professor is it to teach in these times as history is changing on a daily basis? I mean, I wouldn't want to be a history professor and have to answer questions. I don't want to answer questions to my 5, 6, 8, and 14-year-old because, you know, history is changing daily.
Yeah, it sure is. And that's one of the things that we tried to measure. We recently ran a national survey of the American public and asked them such things about, you know, should history change? And, you know, asking just a broad cross-section of the American public. And, you know, most of them said, yes, you know, our understandings of history should change. But then, you know, when you broke it down into various subgroups, you would get, you know, different views on that and, you know, why it should change, all the rest. So, you know, while most people would agree with that statement that, yeah, you know, everything's changing so quickly, you very quickly then, you know, see a lot of divergence from people about, well, you know, why is that happening and should our interpretations of the past even change? It gets, you know, it gets politicized pretty quickly as well.
Mr. Burkholder, you know, I bet your kids are pulling their hair out when they're looking at us adults who are making decisions, and they're probably thinking, why don't they just go to the damn history books? We're doing the same thing these people did, and that's why so many people are dead now. We can stop it. We can fix it. We can change it. What is the reaction of your young scholars as they look at how we have just totally messed up the world for them?
Well, I think, you know, you answered your own question right there. Yeah, you know, they can be dumbfounded, but this is a case where, you know, a little knowledge can be dangerous, right? Because a lot of times they didn't even know that sometimes we're repeating mistakes, and sometimes we repeat successes as well. You know, there's the famous statement that, well, those who, you know, don't learn from the past are doomed to repeat it. But you can actually learn good things to do. It's not all proscriptive. So, but of course, you got to know those things first before you can get frustrated, before you can see that, oh my gosh, we're making the same mistakes over again. So this is, you know, as a historian, obviously I'm biased, but this is one of the reasons why I think history education is so important, even though, you know, it's one of the humanities, it's one of these areas that, you know, tends to get slashed, certainly at the higher ed level, but even to an extent at the K-12 level as well. And, you know, I think that's a mistake, and it's very frustrating to watch it happen right before my eyes.
We're talking to Peter Burkholder. He is a professor at Farley Dickinson University, and that is in New Jersey. He did spend 2 decades living in the Twin Cities. I have to ask you, sir, when you saw our city burning down, you were here for 20 years. You saw the rage, and you saw the anger, and you saw the frustration, and you saw the fear, and you saw the smoke, and you saw journalists getting arrested, and you saw that video that we've all seen at this point, and tell me your reaction.
Yeah, that was tough to watch. You know, I haven't lived in the Twin Cities for 16 years now, although I do get back there, you know, about once a year. And, you know, right where George Floyd was killed, I used to drive past there at least once a week when I was living in South Minneapolis. So, you know, it was very shocking to all these places that I knew, and then seeing, you know, some of the riots and burned down buildings, and, you know, I'm thinking, hey, you know, I know right where that is. And so it was, you know, it was very sad to see it, to be sure. And, you know, various colleagues and even students here, who, you know, don't really, they probably couldn't find Minnesota on a map, where, you know, the Midwest tends to be flyover country. But a lot of them were, you know, a little surprised too, because they have these stereotypes that, well, you know, isn't everybody just real happy and, you know, in Minnesota? And, there, I think they were surprised to see that, well, you had, you know, people of color living in Minnesota. It was just this perception that, well, you know, Minnesota is just white and everybody gets along. And, you know, of course that's never been the case.
We are talking to Peter Burkholder. Now, we have to take a quick commercial break, but when we come back, can you stick around with me for a few more minutes? Because I want to talk more about the history, not just the history that we are teaching the students out of the book, but the history that we are living right now. And, you know, in 10 years, what's going to be told? I need the expert. I need Professor Burkholder to tell me what he thinks will be written in the books when we come back.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress-them-on-the-third-date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
It's 8:21. You are listening to News Talk 830 WCCO Radio, your good neighbor station. My name is Shaletta Brundage, in for Geraldine Steele on Steele Talk. And until 11, you can catch me normally Saturdays from 11 to 2 on the Shaletta Show. And I'm talking to Professor Peter Burkholder. He is with Farley Dickinson University in New Jersey, spent time here in the Twin Cities, lived in Minnesota for 2 decades. You teach history at the university, Professor. What is history going to say 10 years from now about today?
Well, let me preface that by saying, you know, the pages of history are full of people who made very bad predictions about these types of things, and I don't know if I want to join those. I have to put that out there because I don't know. I really don't. You know, historians, we mostly look back, but I appreciate the question. Really hard to say. I mean, I would hope that this would be a transitional moment in a good way, and not a bad way. Where there would be more laws put on the books, and there would be better race relations, for example, going forward. I just don't know how that's going to go. Interestingly, if we think about literally what will the history books say, if you think about a lot of history textbooks, a lot of times, if we're talking about people who oftentimes fall outside of the main historical narrative, they're oftentimes both literally and figuratively marginalized in the textbooks. And that is, if you remember back to like your high school textbook or college textbook, there'll be these inset text boxes about some important woman who lived in the 17th century or something like this. And they're not part of the main narrative. And there have actually been studies then on students' reading habits when they read those texts, and they skip those textbook boxes. So they don't read those things. So something like, George Floyd's murder might be put into a text box someday, and students won't even read it because it's just seen as not part of the narrative. That could happen because things like this have happened in the past. We also consider things like, what is the story of, say, U.S. history that people want to hear? And in our national survey that we recently ran, that was very much a function of party ID, whether, say, U.S. history should be a celebration of the nation's past or whether it should be questioning the nation's past. So, for example, we had 30% of Democrats said that U.S. history should celebrate the nation's past. Compare that with 84% of Republicans who said that it should primarily be about celebrating the nation's past. So that gives you a sense of, whoever is telling the story and, say, who controls the writing of the textbooks and distribution of textbooks to various school districts, that's very much going to determine how this plays out in the stories that are told.
And, that's frightening. Because I grew up in a primarily African-American community. All my teachers were black. My neighborhoods were black. They went to school with my parents. They were members of our church. And so we celebrated black culture and black history. And so there was a lot of supplemental teachings that went on in my classroom when I was in elementary school and junior high. Now, my son, we live out in Cottage Grove. He's the only black kid in his elementary school. And he comes home, Professor Burkholder, and he has a project about Christopher Columbus. And he said all these amazingly great things about Christopher Columbus and the discoveries he made. And I was like, son, who told you that? And he was like, oh, and then we have to do this project on Christopher Columbus. And so we had to sit down and talk about exactly who Christopher Columbus was and what he did not discover and how he took slaves and, you know, the entire narrative about that. And so I had to sit down and talk to his teacher about mm-hmm. revisionist history. And, you know, and it made me remember, you know, one textbook down in Texas. And I'm not sure if you remember the story where the kid came home and in the textbook, they talked about the slave trade as if they were immigrants looking for work. You know, they had pretty much rewritten that part of history out of the books. How does something like that happen? How does that slip through the cracks?
Yeah, well... As a historian, I mean, it shouldn't, but, you know, as I was saying from those stats, you can see that there are really stark divides here on, you know, what is the story that should be taught about, particularly, you know, U.S. history, that for obvious reasons, that's the most politicized. I mean, my primary training is in medieval history, and, you know, that's not nearly as politicized, by the way. But a lot of times, you know, the people that are selecting, you know, textbooks for districts, these are people who are, you know, not trained in those subject areas. So, you know, they're bringing with them some sort of agenda, and they've already decided, well, here's what the students should learn. So, yeah, I mean, Texas is oftentimes, you know, the classic case, or, you know, how in some textbooks, how it's the Civil War is the war of Northern aggression, for example. This type of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly goes on. And then you were saying, you know, you effectively had to fill in the gaps or tell a different story completely from what your son was taught at school. So, you know, that's offloading a lot of responsibility to the parents, which, you know, isn't necessarily a bad thing insofar as when parents talk with their kids about history.
I was going to say, but suppose I had been out of town that week for work. Suppose yeah. I had been gone and had not, you know, had a chance to talk to him about his day, or if I was sick or busy with the other kids. What would he have taken with him for the rest of his life about who Christopher Columbus was, and how would that project have been completed? Listen, I love my husband, but if my son comes home with a project, he's going to do the project. He went to that Christopher Columbus coloring book homework assignment, and it would have just gotten done. And, you know, I sat on the phone with that teacher for 30 minutes. But this is what I don't understand, Professor Burkholder, is the truth is the truth. And history is history. How do we get away from what actually happened and tell a different story?
How do we do it, huh?
How do we do that? How do we get there?
Yeah, it's interesting. Because getting back to the same national survey we ran, one question we asked people was, what do they think history is? And two-thirds of them said that they think that history is just factual stuff. It's just names, dates, facts, the usual, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you ask the same question to a bunch of professional historians, they would say that, well, you know, yeah, names, dates, facts, all that stuff matters. But really what we want to get at is, you know, history as an explanation mm-hmm. of experiences in the past. And that's a little different thing. It's a higher order way of thinking about things. So one way that we can maybe get away from it is to be approaching history not so much as, well, you know, here's just a set of facts that people are supposed to know, because that gets you into what's called the history wars. And people just start fighting about, well, okay, you know, what facts are we going to teach? And there's nearly an infinite number of facts that you could teach, mm-hmm. And you could justify them if you really wanted to. But if you approach the past instead as, you know, a series of problems, and how do we make sense of this, and how do we use those facts to explain something, you're going to get a different result. And the good news is that even if you don't touch on various topics, because there's always too much material to try to cover in any given class, there's always going to be that problem. But if you can get people to think about things in certain ways, and they can approach, say, primary sources and embrace the ambiguity of those, or they can evaluate evidence-based arguments made by other historians, then they'll probably be able to take the ball and run with it instead of being, you know, wholly reliant on whatever sort of facts that they're taught or not taught in any given history classroom.
Well, you have educated us on tonight. I feel like I need a grade or something, because this has been an absolute education for me. Professor Peter Burkholder with Farley Dickinson University, former Twin Cities resident. When you get back to town, you're going to have to look us up. You cannot come back. You say you come back once a year. You cannot come to the Twin Cities without visiting us here at News Talk 830 WCCO Radio. Be a good neighbor to us so we can pick your brain again, sir.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for being here. And stick around, you all. Don't go anywhere. We will continue to talk about how the murder of George Floyd turned into a nationwide movement here on Still Talking. It's 8:36. You're listening to News Talk 830 WCCO Radio, your good neighbor station. It's Still Talking with Geraldine Steele, but tonight you're hanging out with Shaletta Brundage and Jonathan Lowe. And I got to say, I am getting a ton of messages on Twitter and Facebook telling me they are really digging the music that Jonathan is playing. It's almost like I got my own DJ. Cozy Denise on Twitter is like, I'm loving that bumper music. So shout out to Jonathan for being an awesome DJ tonight, as well as a producer. And, you know, we're talking about the anniversary of the death of George Floyd. It's coming up this week. There are so many events going on in and around, not just the Twin Cities, the state and the world. And, you know, what's changed in this past year? What's changed? The way we look at criminal conduct. Will sentences be reduced or reexamined? Were convictions correct? It's just kind of making us rethink the way we look at life and law and law enforcement. Is justice really blind? Well, I had to call somebody to answer those questions, so I got Sarah Jones on the phone. She is the head of the Great Northern Innocence Project. Sarah, thank you so much for being on Still Talking tonight.
Thank you, Shaletta. I'm happy to be talking with you.
Now, talk to me about the Great Northern Innocence Project.
Well, we used to be the Innocence Project of Minnesota, and a couple of years ago, we started taking cases from North Dakota and South Dakota as well, and so we changed our name to the Great North Innocence Project. We have been around since 2001, and we help free innocent people who've been wrongly convicted. In other words, people who are in prison for crimes they had nothing to do with. And then we also work on making policy changes to improve the criminal legal system to prevent wrongful convictions.
And I got to imagine your work is very busy. And, you know, people like to joke and say, well, you know, everybody in jail says they didn't do it. Everybody who commits a crime says that they're innocent and that somebody else did it. But you know what, Sarah? In a lot of cases, we're seeing this happen over and over again where, you know, somebody's been sitting in jail for 10, 20, 30 years and someone else's DNA is there and it's not theirs once they finally decide to take a DNA test, or somebody comes and admits to the crime. And there have been people who have been executed and now they're looking at the cases and their DNA was nowhere even at the crime scene. Somebody else's DNA was there. And so I imagine that, especially now with everything that's going on with George Floyd's case, and we take a closer look at police misconduct, that you're taking a closer look at a lot of your cases.
Yeah, I mean, I think we like to think that we've always heavily scrutinized every case, every application that we get from somebody. But I think, you know, absolutely, we're humans, and the more we learn and the more we understand the ways that our system can fail, the closer we need to look. And we figure out how the system can go wrong. And we just know that anything that humans have involvement with, there are ways it can go wrong.
And when people come, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
You were saying, you also do what?
Well, I was just going to say that, we know from looking back and from looking at the present that our criminal legal system has a lot of inherent racial bias. And so if we know that, and we also can see from the facts, from cases where innocent people were exonerated, they were found to be wrongfully convicted, the disproportionate impact has been on Black people and people of color. So, we know that we have to look for the signs, regardless of the race of whoever applies to us for our help. But it's a fact that these things happen disproportionately to Black people and people of color.
And talk to me about the people that are coming to you. I can imagine that your office is bombarded with people and family and cases. Talk to me about that.
We every year receive about 400 inquiries and requests from help from people, whether it's family members or the people who are actually in prison. And we require, in order to officially open a case, that the person affected has to actually write to us. So if, mm-hmm. if a friend or family member contacts us, we let them know, well, your son or your loved one or your friend has to write to us themselves. And so from that, we get about 200 inquiries per year, written requests from actual people claiming they're innocent. And we look at every single one of those cases to see if they meet the criteria that we require to take on a case. And then, probably again, half of those, we go into a deeper investigation. And investigations can take a long time, and it means finding witnesses. It means finding evidence. It means trying to get DNA tests done, all kinds of work that goes on behind the scenes. And again, it's very work intensive, very time consuming, but we do it very carefully. And then we narrow that down. And again, maybe half of those cases go into a much deeper investigation. And then in any given year, we have, maybe a dozen cases that are actually in court where we have taken on somebody's case as their lawyer and we are fighting for them to be freed. So it's kind of a needle in a haystack in a system that has, a lot of other issues with it. But we're looking for the people who are actually innocent of the crimes for which they were convicted. And we have freed seven people now in Minnesota and North Dakota. And we're going to keep fighting for more people to be freed. And we have a great new partnership with Attorney General Keith Ellison for a conviction review unit that his office is establishing. And that organization is going to be looking at cases for innocence as well as unjust sentencing. So it's going to be a little bit of a broader scope, but that's something that we helped set up. And we're going to keep working through our own office and through referring cases to that conviction review unit, and hope to get as many people out of prison who are innocent as possible.
How important are those partnerships? We're talking to Sarah Jones, the head of the Great Northern Innocence Project. You talked about a partnership with Attorney General Keith Ellison. How important are those?
It is really important. Conviction review units are relatively new in the United States. We are one of, I believe now, five that are statewide. In other words, we're looking at cases from the whole state of Minnesota. Many conviction review units are started by a county prosecutor or district attorney, and they're only looking at their own cases. But these are cropping up all over the United States, and it's part of a newer trend of prosecutors taking the responsibility of looking at their own cases and saying, did we make a mistake here? Did we convict the wrong person, or did we you know, in our case, we're looking at unjust sentences, too. So, you know, what makes a sentence unjust? Was it a juvenile who was sentenced to life without possibility of parole, and the United States Supreme Court has now said that's unjust? So they're really important. It's kind of the next part of the evolution of looking at cases differently. You know, kind of the when we know better, we do better.
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of the way I look at it.
Yeah, and you know, talk to me about the freedom. Because you said that, you know, you got seven people free. Oh, my God. I just take me back to the last person. Who was it? And when they came walking out of that jail, girl, tell me about it. I want to know.
Well, the last two people were last year. And mm-hmm. one of them, Ronnie Cooper, is actually from New York. So he's home in New York now. And it's a case that our newest staff attorney, Andrew Marquardt, had been working on as a private lawyer, and then he joined our staff, and he and his old law firm continued to work on this case for Ronnie. It was a case in federal court in Tennessee, and he had been working on it for free for a few years, and he kept working on it after he joined us, and Ronnie went home to his family in time for his son's high school graduation. He had been in prison for 10 years. He was on a 30-year sentence. And so he would have been in prison for another 20 years. And then soon before that, we were able to free Javon Davis, who is from Minneapolis. And he was in prison for an attempted murder that he did not commit. And our legal director, Julie Jonas, and staff attorney, Jim Mayer, and our board member, John Hopeman, and some law students worked on his case. And he was eventually freed after serving about 6 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. And now he's home and able to be a father to his children. You know, he missed those precious years of being with them. And he's coaching youth basketball again. And, you know, he said, "I'm not just innocent, I'm Innocence Project innocent." And that really brought home, you know, that we look at the cases where the person had nothing to do with the crime for which they were convicted. You know, they weren't there. They weren't a part of it. Nothing to do with it. And he gave up 6 years of his life for something he didn't do. Mm. And, you know, now he's back contributing to the community and parenting mm-hmm. his children. And, you know, freedom means everything.
But, you know, and we talk about that with COVID, how we've been locked down, how we've been in the house, what we've missed out on just in 1 year. Imagine what he missed out on in six.
Well, yeah. I mean, prison is nothing like being stuck at home.
No, ma'am, it's not.
You know, and, you know, Javon was freed right before we were all, everything shut down for the pandemic. So we were able to greet him when he walked out of prison. Ronnie, we couldn't be there when he came home because of COVID. Mm-hmm. Luckily he had a family member who could be there for him, but you know, being in prison and COVID was rampant in our prisons.
Mm-hmm.
People don't have the opportunity to socially distance. They don't have the mm-hmm. opportunity to sanitize everything. It's you know, there's no comparison.
No. And we're talking to Sarah Jones. She is the head of the Great Northern Innocence Project. Now, I know you got to go, but I would love for you to stick around for just one more segment with me, because I want to talk more about those unjust sentences. More than getting innocent people out of jail, it is the unfairness of some of these harsher sentences, especially for African-American men and women. How does that impact the system? How does that impact families? We're going to find out next. You don't have to go looking far to find injustices in sentencing for African-American men and women. A Louisiana man was serving a life sentence for stealing a pair of hedge clippers in 1997. He was paroled after serving more than two decades in prison. Sarah Jones is with the Great Northern Innocence Project. Sarah, how are you working to erase and eradicate situations like that from happening to somebody else?
Well, you know, within our mission, we aren't really looking at cases of unjust sentencing. We take cases where the person actually had nothing to do with the crime that is alleged to have happened. But as part of our new conviction review unit that we got a grant for and we partnered with the Attorney General's office for, that conviction review unit is eventually going to be looking at cases of unjust sentencing, cases where, you know, things are just so out of proportion to the underlying crime, so that even if the person did actually commit a crime, they should be serving a sentence that's appropriate and not serving prison time or
a life sentence for stealing some damn hedge clippers, girl.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
And everybody sat back and thought that was okay. That was not okay. Nobody spoke up for more than 2 decades.
I mean, some of the stuff you just look at and you go, how could we have ever thought that was appropriate? And so I hope that we are, you know, kind of building the momentum to really take a look at these things and think about how we want to, you know, deal out justice. And, you know, people are going to come out of prison and they're going to be our neighbors. These are real human beings and they deserve second chances. And, you know, we shouldn't be just warehousing people in cages. We need to look at what we want to accomplish with the justice system and make sure that we're doing it in a way that's fair and appropriate.
See, you just took the words out of my mouth. I was about to say, if you hadn't said it fair, nowhere else in this country is anybody going to give a man a life sentence for stealing hedge clippers. And they're surely not going to do it if that man is white. And so it's frightening. And I'm so glad that you are there doing the work. Sarah Jones, the head of the Great Northern Innocence Project, I appreciate you so much for being on the Good Neighbor Station.
Thank you so much, Shaletta. This show is so important, and I'll keep listening tonight.
Oh, thank you so much. And you have been a blessing to us and to our listeners. You all stick around. Don't go anywhere. Center Stage is up next. All things arts and entertainment. I've been watching that Sounds of Blackness on the BBMAs tonight, and they tore it up, brought the house down. Billy, Gary, Patty, and all the cast of characters were there. They represented Minnesota well. We'll be talking about that next.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.